Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to Talk Art. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And today we are joined by a national treasure, officially, Jimmy. Jimmy the Chihuahua. And also...
Hello, Jimmy.
Jimmy can't...
Jimmy's the best guest ever, because Jimmy's already been like tapping my arm, demanding hugs. I mean, gotta love Jimmy.
Jimmy's sat on the lap of a true national treasure.
But this is actually a first, isn't it? I don't think we've had a dog actually in the recording.
No, we've had Rocky in the other side of the glass, watching, observing, but
where
we've never
today.
Had a dog in the booth. Right. So this is a massive treat for us. But we have the man, the legend, Martin Creed.
Right. Hello, Martin.
Hi. Welcome. Right.
Good morning, good morning.
Right. It's also another first, because you're actually a Turner Prize winner, and we've never had a Turner Prize winner on our podcast before.
That's true.
That is true. So, yeah, all the way back in 2001.
Yeah, amazing.
Embarrassing you right now. You're like, yes,
yeah. How do you feel? So how do you feel about being referred to as a national treasure now?
All right, I don't know. Well, I don't know. I suppose, I think it's quite funny.
Yeah.
Aye.
You do, which is good.
Aye.
That's good.
I don't know. But actually, I try not to read anything about like reviews or anything like that.
Oh, really?
But I do sometimes look at them from a distance.
What?
You know?
What? In retrospect, when the show's finished, you were then.
I mean, from a few meters away.
Oh, so you're going to pick out certain words.
I get the basic idea.
Got it.
I just because I get hurt too easily.
Do you? Yeah.
And I just start thinking about it.
You're analysing it too much.
Yeah, and maybe then I feel like I really easily feel sort of taken over by things that, like, either people I'm with or just experiences. And so if I read stuff, then... I quite easily get obsessed with it.
Of course.
In one way or another.
Well, that's the case with any creatives, I guess. I mean, I'm an actor, and I think you get reviews come out, if you end up reading the reviews and you see something in them that's, you know, positive sometimes, that can throw you. That can kind of fuck you up a bit. And then the negative stuff obviously does fuck you up. Aye. But the positive stuff can spin you off somewhere else. Or if someone says, oh, I like the way you delivered that line, or I like the way that you said this, which I guess is the same situation for you, is it, when you read a review... It can, if it shows you something that you didn't know was there, but in a way that kind of scares you or you weren't, that people's depiction of you, what they're projecting onto you, that can kind of throw you, right?
Yeah. And also, I often agree with the negative criticism, or I might partly agree with it or something like that. And then
is that because you just want to hurt yourself, or is that genuinely?
Well, I think I'm quite good at that, but maybe a lot of people are. But
yes,
But then again, you know, I do worry about getting, if you're too much in a bubble and don't you know, if you don't read
interact
reviews
with...
and don't whatever, you know, then I feel like that's a dangerous.
Course,
because that just leads to you being on your own in a room.
Sure. But your work is so interactive and so kind of dependent on the public's experience with it that kind of turns it on and brings it alive.
I feel like it's really important for me to do things out in the world. I don't really have a studio, particularly.
Oh, right.
Like, which is for the same reason that I'm worried about that if I'm too much. On my own, and I like being on my own, and I'm on my own quite a lot working.
Yeah, insular,
But if I do that too much, I just go off on one in my own kind of fantasy world. So I feel like it's important for me to try and get real about things as early as possible.
But have you noticed a difference in the work then when that has been your experience, where you have retreated or become a bit reclusive with it?
Aye.
Do you?
Well, because then I think it's just a real shock to go into the world which doesn't just have me in it and then see what the stuff is like that I've been working on.
Got it.
You know, I mean, yeah. It's a bit like, and that's also why I do a lot of gigs and that, or I like with the music and that, just because that feels like the only way to find out about it. And it's the same, but an exhibition to me is a gig, basically.
Yes.
You know, it's a live show.
Yeah.
That's on, it's just on for what, a month instead of an hour or whatever, but it's still a live show.
Yeah.
I've always been really fascinated in your work by how music is so, it almost like informs a lot of the sort of way you approach making art in a way, because I read that bit where you were talking about scores of music and how you can almost read a score of music and it gives you the set of rules or something that how you're even the crescendo or the different instructions, and then how it can be performed differently by different musicians or in different even buildings or acoustics, or and it constantly changes and evolves. And then if you apply that logic to a lot of your artwork, I often see that real link, which isn't necessarily something I think about with lots of other artists, but I love how, even though you might, I don't know how you, maybe you can explain this, but whether you see yourself as just like an artist who makes music, or whether you are a musician separately from being an artist, or whether it's all just you being a human being creative. But for me, it's all very linked, the whole thing.
Aye, well, I've definitely really very self-consciously made some visual works that in which I was trying to make a piece that was a visual work that was more like a piece of music, but the thing, one of the things I was thinking about, I've been thinking about a lot, is the fact that that everything is a live experience, and so when you look at something, and that's maybe obvious with music, that it's obvious, it's more obvious possibly that when a piece of music is on, you know, you're it's on, and then when it's off, it's finished, you know. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's not so obvious possibly with visual work, but I think that it's the same thing, so looking at something is a live experience, just which is always different. But and you might think that the painting or whatever it is you're looking at, that might have these shapes on it that seem like they're fixed, you know. There might be a red circle and a blue square, and those might never change because the painting is, you know, going to stay like that if it dried, you know. Mm-hmm. but the fact is that you're different from moment to moment, and so it doesn't matter whether the painting stays the same. You're changing all the time, and therefore the experience of looking at a painting is always a live one that is ever changing, and so basically everything's a live event, that, you know, even looking at a painting, that's the way but I feel like I learned that, I don't know if I could say that's a fact, but I feel like that about it, and I feel like I came to that from music, from doing music and thinking it wasn't so different, really.
But do you mean looking at the painting as in physically where you stand in the gallery looking at it, your experience there, or you mean as a human being you might look at it today and in a year's time look at it and you feel differently?
Well, I mean both. Because physically you might be looking at that painting, you might have a stomach ache one day, a headache the next day, and you might have, or you might be, or having a laugh with a pal or a hangover eye, and you're physically moving, but then there's your feelings as well, so it's always live. So I suppose in music you've got the person, and then the music itself is changing all the time. So you've got two things that are changing. Mm. You know? Mm. And with visual work, you've got the people who are changing all the time, and then you've got although I know you've got a lot of visual work that isn't fixed, but a lot of it is fixed in place, and then you've just got one element that's moving and one that's not moving.
The observer.
Kinetically, I mean.
Yes, right.
But physically. But But that's how I got into making a lot of work that does move and change, you know.
Well, we were talking about this last night about music, but the fact that there is a rhythm that runs through all your work, and especially what you rose to prominence with when you won the Turner Prize was at the Lights On, Lights Off work number 227, which is an empty gallery space, very ballsy. Lights go on, 5 seconds, lights go off. And there's lots of works of yours that have, in the description, in the title, the timing for, like, this is going to go on for 1 second, 1 second off. And the metronome features a lot in your work. And it feels like there is a constant rhythm and a beat that goes through the works that, you know, the public might not be aware of. That's my feeling with your work. So it pulses, you know.
Right.
You saying that about the kind of, because you'd make a lot of paintings, there is a stillness in them because they are quite geometric, a lot of the work, especially the kind of the boxes piled up and everything. But the fact that your work is so triggered by the public and that interaction keeps that movement going throughout, the vibration through all your pieces.
Definitely rhythm, it seems like, or repeated.
Yes.
Things seem like, I mean, it's obvious to me that, I mean, I must like that.
Yes.
Or get something from it, because I do it a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think it is partly a comfort thing. I think that it can be, that in a world where everything is changing all the time and is sort of chaotic, and in my internal, I mean, I'm talking about my internal world as well as, you know, if I look out on the street and, you know, the whole world, which I wouldn't distinguish really between the inner and outer worlds, but that's so ever changing and chaotic, and sometimes it can just feel like I'm just falling, you know.
Got it.
And so, I see. To me, a lot of these works and things that I make are like basically something to hang on to.
Well, it's, you know, finding like order. Your work's about finding the order.
And you have rules.
But it's like see it more like a it's like a fence. It's like building a fence,
right?
With it, just got a you know, and obviously fences often have like a rhythm, you know,
of course,
pattern.
Balance.
And then you know, and through that fence, you can basically enjoy the world. You know, you can look at the lions and tigers on the other side of the fence, and you're safe. You know, you're basically, it protects you from the chaos, but it lets you see.
So there's a safety in that.
You can enjoy all the stupid stuff going on as well.
I've always felt,
you know, so it's like a framework.
I've always felt with your work that the rules that you put in place, say at the beginning of making a work, for example, because you often have these kind of sets of rules or order, somehow then create incredible freedom or joy or something. It's like out of the kind of strictness of setting up the order, you actually get the opposite. You get this kind of complete release and joy, and like, you know, it's a bit like when you fill up the room with balloons, where it's like half the air in the room, the volume of the room is actually blown up in ordinary balloons. And then once people start walking into that, it suddenly becomes, like, out of that rule, becomes this complete, you know, and it's also a unique experience for every single person that goes into it. Because some people might like rubber, other people might find it terrifying. Some people might get scared of when the balloon explodes or whatever. But I love all those, the kind of complexity of all of that experience that you can have out of that very simple rule making.
But the making, like, having a framework to me is like that, like having a fence where you can, if with the balloons, you know,
Parameters.
If you
give yourself a parameter, and then within that parameter you feel safe and you can explore
you need to contain
that space. Yeah. To be able to do that exploration.
Yeah, and you have to contain it for other people to be able to enjoy
know
or whatever, because otherwise it's just everything being everywhere and it's all over the place, you know?
Yeah.
You know, over the years, Martin, like, I've been looking at sort of, I guess, what we call contemporary art probably since I was 21 or something. And over the years, your work has constantly, like, popped up, and I often see it in different places, and often it's very different looking in a way, but I always know it's you. And one of the funny things that I've always found is, like, the lasting impact it has on me. So, for example, I remember walking into the Savile Row space at Hauser & Wirth with the sculpture Mothers, which is actually, since we've been mentioning to people we were going to interview, so many people bring that sculpture up.
No, really?
And I swear it's gone into so many people's psyche because there's something about this idea of mothers. That's got, so this, for everyone who doesn't know, is a giant, is it like 25 foot tall or something? It's huge. Or it's big.
Oh, maybe I don't know the exact dimensions, but I made it as big as possible within the room. The first place that was exhibited, I made it as big as it could be there.
So it's this giant sculpture with the word lit up that says Mothers. And it's
neon, isn't it?
It's a neon. Aye. And it actually spins around above you. And it's got this kind of, it can be...
But only inches above
your head. Exactly.
You feel the wind as it passes your head. What do you do if someone really tall's in there? Is there this as you walk in the gallery? Or?
I don't know. There was a lot of discussion about that kind of thing. Yeah, because it's less than... It would hit you if you were in.
It must be like 7 foot.
It's about 7 feet the bottom of it, from the floor.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Because I'm 6 foot two, and I remember it literally, I could feel it.
It feels like it is
going to...
Yeah. Even I'm 6 foot one, and I feel like it's going to hit me.
And that work is so genius, because it's like...
Does it constantly spin, or is it on a timer?
It goes, it constantly spins, but it goes from as slow as it can be, and then it speeds up to fast, and then slows down again, so it's on a cycling...
Okay, got it. Cyclical, yeah.
Accelerating and decelerating thing.
Very cool. Very cool.
And it's good, for me, it's just like, when I first saw it, I was like, that's so cool, like celebrating mothers somehow, like this idea of... Mothers.
A monument to mothers.
Yeah, it's kind of like this big monument to mothers. And then you've also got this other like tension, because as it's spinning across you, it's almost like menacing somehow. And it's kind of, it becomes something completely other.
Very imposing,
but
yeah.
Psychologically, it's so true, because everyone, you know, has their parents in their head at some point in their life, whether you let it go or you don't let it go or whatever. But I loved that, the simplicity of it. And that for me is just like the, I don't know, that's...
Well, it makes you feel like an infant, I guess. It makes me think of the Muppet Babies. And in the Muppet Babies, you used to have mum's legs would come in. You'd never see her, but you'd only see it from the Muppet Babies POV.
Right.
And, yeah, so that feels like, it's the, like you're the infant. There's the mother up there spinning around, getting on with her life, being really powerful, matriarchal. And you're below, kind of avoiding and smiling and trying to see, get a better view of her. That's what it feels like for me.
How did that work come about?
It came about... I feel like a lot of works come about quite without, there's not necessarily that much thought goes into it, and or the thought happens later or whatever. But it was more or less from, I'd done a lot of these neon works with words, and I first got into that from doing, because of doing a public work, so it was outdoors, and that's how I first did the neon, because I thought, well, the neon, you know, if it's lit up, people will be able to see it out, you know. So, and Mothers was actually inside, but that's how I got into neon, because of kind of have wanting stuff to be seen at night, things. But I did a lot of things where I wrote words in neon, like, or phrases like "everything is going to be all right" was one of the first ones. And
that's travelled around the world, that one, as well. I was listening to some New Zealand radio station. That was up in New Zealand.
There's one in Christchurch, which is in a museum there.
Yes.
And I get into that because of doing things like the lights going on and off and these kind of abstract works, I don't know that's what you'd call them, but wanting to communicate more directly, as I saw it, using words.
Yep.
And often thinking when I was talking about work, thinking, oh, well, I'm talking, why, if I'm talking about the work like this, why don't I just have the words, you know, as the work, you know? And that's how I get into these neon words and things. And then, but it always bothered me. The first neon I made was made for a specific building, so it was the length of the building. You know, that was
this the Tate Britain one?
That is the Tate Britain one,
so
but
that
wasn't made for that. It wasn't made for that building. It was eventually fitted.
So it's the whole world plus the work.
They also own "Everything Is Going to Be All Right." Actually, the original which was from the East End, from Clapton. And that was the one I'm talking about, with that was the full length of the building.
Right.
And But then because I got on a bit of a roll with doing these neons, and I started making some smaller ones mm-hmm. for galleries and things. But it always bothered me that the size. It's like, why is it that size? I mean, if it's on a building, then it's clear that it's because that's the amount of space I've got, you know. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was funny, like, and then I was always thinking, oh, but why don't you just write it on a bit of paper? I mean, why are you doing a neon? Mm. You know, if it's not, I mean, and I started getting bothered by that, and so mothers came about from thinking about the size of words and what difference it makes, really, if it makes a difference at all, and thinking, oh, why don't I make a really big, what if it's a really big as possible, you know, words really big? And I think that's how it came about, because I was just thinking about that and thinking, well, what word could be done really big? Mm. And I thought of mothers because I think this is how it came about, but I'm not sure, maybe I'm making this up. It's something like that. It's definitely an experiment in making words as big as possible. Because I was thinking that mothers have to be big physically. You know, obviously a baby has to be small. I mean, the mother has to be bigger than... You can't have a mother that's smaller than the baby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, the physical size is part of the equation. But so, and then I just started thinking it was funny, you know, imagining a huge thing saying mothers, you know, and also because a mother's being a shortening of motherfuckers as well, which is part of it.
That changes the work for me. I wasn't aware. I was thinking of my mom and her lovely shit. No, I'm thinking of motherfuckers. Great. Okay.
Mothers. And then that work led to another work, I think, because that's the right order anyway, in New York, where you did the word understanding in red neon, which I think is literally one of my favourite works, like, pretty much ever. Yeah. Simply because the word understanding, and I know, like, there's a lot going on in American politics right now and all that stuff, but what year did you do that? 2016?
It must have been 2016.
Because it's kind of recent, isn't it?
Aye.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Recent history.
That was a conscious attempt to, like, make a kind of... Like,
but that was since Trump was in power, you made that.
Because
he came in 2016.
I don't know if he was.
And no, he wasn't in power.
Wasn't he?
He wasn't.
No, but the world was... Okay, it felt like... Not that the world has ever been not in a terrible situation, but it did feel like that it would been the year before had been the terrible refugee crisis, as it was called, even though it was always a refugee crisis, but what got called that at the time in Europe, and ground zero being even where I did understanding was, you know, you could actually see from there the new building they've built. On the
Freedom Tower,
the World Trade Center thing, you know, so I just thought, if I'm doing something in New York like that, it's got to, in the world now as it was then, it's got to be a some kind of like peace monument or something.
Yeah, it's got to resonate.
Like,
what I quite like,
it's got
about
to be
it,
literal in some way, not too subtle.
Yes.
Yes. What I like about the fact it spins is that you read understanding and then you see it back to front, so it's, you don't understand it.
Right.
You see everyone go, what does that say? Oh, understanding. Oh, I get it now. It has that kind of...
But, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But actually, the spinning thing as well, that was part of that. That was going back to the mothers, which spun round as well, was that I was just thinking that words, you always basically read them, and why can't they face in all different directions? You know, why do they always have to be the same way round?
Got it.
You know... But understanding's got a joke in it that you can stand under it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that is one of the... Yeah. That was kind of an extra... things like that help. Like with motherfuckers, if there's a little thing in it, like a stupid pun or something,
yes,
that often helps me to
take
the leap to do it.
But that is your work. Your work is fun.
It's a bit stupid, you know.
Yeah, yeah, great.
Not too... If it's all serious and kind of like all calculated and kind of like...
But that is your work. Your work is fun. Your work is joyful. And then words bounce around your pieces because people have experiences in it and they're normally smiling.
Right.
You know, they might be confused at times or they might be frustrated, but there is a smile there. There's a half
smile. There's actually a hilarious video on YouTube of some like... American journalist who is just running around understanding under that sculpture.
Not really?
Asking the public what they think of it, and he doesn't have a clue what it's about. But I think he's actually kind of joking, but it's very funny. And he's by the end of it, he falls over because he's so exhausted trying to keep up with it. He runs around at the speed of your sculpture. He's sort of racing around, and he's like, I'm trying to see how I can keep up with contemporary art. It's actually really funny. But I loved that because I was just like, well, that's kind of what it's all about.
Yeah.
But understanding for me as well, I heard you talk about this idea of peace and about how to get peace. You might never be able to fall in love with somebody that you don't share the same opinions with, but you might be able to understand them. And that the whole problem with the world and the reason we're all at conflict the whole time is because no one actually takes the time to really understand each other. And I've also read the guy actually who commissioned that project from the American
Public Art Fund.
Yeah, he described you as a poet of the everyday, and I was just like, that's so exactly what it is, though. It's like this, somehow you manage to get to the root of like human emotion and human complexities, but in a very simple way.
Yeah, you reduce everything to what its perfection is. You don't need anything else.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I feel like we're just like saying we love
we're
you.
We're just basically wanking over
but,
you.
Right
yeah. Now. It's very nice of you to say. Yeah.
Anyway, one of our favourite questions on the podcast is what is your favourite colour? And I'm really fascinated to ask you this one because I don't know if you're ever going to be able to answer it. But
Well, it would be easy to say all the colours, but in fact, it's probably yellow.
Really?
Aye, I think so. Aye.
And why yellow?
Well, that's what comes to mind when you ask the question. But
it's a calming one, isn't it? Yellow's, you should paint your bedroom walls yellow. Well, I remember when I was a kid, you meant to, because it's
really?
A concentration, but it's calming and it's soothing. Yeah.
Is it cool?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I've always thought that because of, you know, Van Gogh and all that,
yes.
Kind of yellow being associated with craziness. But I mean that I wouldn't say that's why I like it because I'm just talking about liking yellow in a way like
you're
like,
drawn to it.
Mustard.
Wow. There you go. Yeah.
But the first, when I started numbering my work.
Yeah, why did you do that?
Because I didn't like because I just thought titles were sort of pretentious.
Got it.
And when I was at art school as well, everyone put like. That was in the period where everything was called untitled.
Yes.
And then with brackets, an actual, then there'd be a title.
Title, right. Got it. And then, kind of pretentious. Yeah.
And then with the numbers, I just thought, well, actually, that came from music as well because I grew up with classical music, learning violin and stuff. And so I knew that about all these kind of Beethoven opus numbers and all, you know, and so I thought, oh, why can't I just have catalogue numbers effectively for these things and not have titles?
And the interesting part of this is that all of Martin's works are called like work number with a number. And then occasionally you have an explanation of almost like the process of what it actually is. So if it's like a pack of blue tack that you have to like, you know, put into blobs of blue tack around a room or whatever it is. But what I find really interesting is you kind of went back. So when you first started doing the numbering, you didn't start at number one. You started at work number three.
Aye.
And this was like 91, wasn't it? 92, is that right? That kind of time? And then,
yeah.
And then but the first, the actual work number three, which is the earliest currently work number, is from 1986. So it's kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah. What, yeah. So explain all that.
Yeah, because when I decided to number them, I went back and corrected, took away all the titles and gave numbers to things.
Oh, so you did start titling?
I had some titles at first, which were just quite straightforward titles, really. But I suppose it has to do a lot with words, and that was before I was doing anything with words as the work being the words, but you know, I suppose it's because you know, I suppose because if you put a title on thing, so often it feels like you're what I don't know what you're trying to do. I mean obviously if something has a title, it's all that's obviously part of the whole work. I mean,
Yeah.
No, there's no other.
Well, it informs so much, doesn't it? Because also it allows people to project into something.
But the but the first work that I numbered was this work number 3. That's a yellow painting.
Ah, yeah.
I still quite like that painting.
Do you know all your works? If we told you a number, would you know what it was?
No, probably. Oh. I'd know some of them.
Would you?
Really? Try,
can we try? Get the book.
No
book.
Way.
Yes, get the book. All right.
Oh, yeah, so everyone, you should get this book, by the way. It's from Thames and Hudson. It's called Martin Creed Works, which is the perfect title for this.
Has that got a work number, the book?
Well, the design does, yeah.
Does it?
Yeah, it is a work of art in itself. I mean, I love this book.
The binding.
And actually, this is one of my favourite things anyone's ever done in a book, because it says, I fear this book. On the spine of the book, if you see it on a bookshelf, it says, I fear this book. I dare not look as bit by bit I trawl my shit. I don't think I want to make a book of my work. And it goes on, and it's from the forward, and in the book it's like a 3-page forward, which is incredible.
Come on in, let's go.
Anyway, yeah, so... how do we do this, though?
You just say a work number.
Oh, and you say what it is?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, that's so hard.
It's a test.
That is hard.
Oh, my God.
How many work numbers have we got in there?
I'm going to try and find
I would something. Definitely know some of them.
Okay, hang on.
I mean...
I'm going to try.
This is fun.
Work number 422.
No, I don't know.
I mean, I don't know how you're going to know.
If you go with a smaller number, I might know it.
But
less than 100.
less than 10.
Oh, here we go. Work number 88.
A crumpled ball of paper.
Yeah, you know it. That's what I was just thinking, though.
That's one of your most famous.
Exactly. It's got to be the ones like work number 79.
Some blue tack needed rolled into ball. Is it?
Yes. Well.
Well, again, you've chosen like.
I know, but that's what I'm saying.
Smash hits.
But then I think that's just common sense, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you know? Oh, I love these. What about work number 429?
Oh, no, I'm looking at.
Oh, no,
oh,
looking
it's
at
cheating.
It. That's like when you're at school.
You look at someone else's answers.
Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
And what is your... If sometimes we ask this really silly question, but...
Sometimes, every time.
Okay, every time. If you could go into a museum and do an art heist, what work would you steal and take home?
Oh. All right. Maybe Leonardo da Vinci's woman with an ermine.
With a fox.
Wow.
Aye. Wow.
Is it a fox? An ermine? Is that a type of fox?
And there's a fox in there as well, isn't there? Lady with ermine and fox or something.
Oh, really?
Yes, I think so.
But anyway, she's holding in her arms.
Good one. A bit like you right now. You're holding Jimmy.
No, it isn't. You're right. I don't know what I'm thinking of. Ignore me.
Which I remember seeing that in that museum in Krakow. I don't know if that's where it is.
Oh, really?
In Poland. But, I like that. I mean, I like a lot of paintings, though.
That's Holbein, yeah.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's brilliant.
That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
I like him.
And I automatically went to, which I just showed you a picture of, is Hans Holbein painting of a woman with Stalin and Fox. Do you know that one?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
Good one.
Thank you. Which is beautiful.
Yeah. That's so classy, Ross. That's so like... Well, yeah. Wow, I'm really impressed.
I know. Well, it just looked like earlier on I was giving Martin the wrong animal. I felt like a knob.
Well done.
So I'm glad we clarified that.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, it was nice to see it. I like it.
Yeah. Good.
Cool. When you were growing up, what made you want to be an artist or become an artist?
Because
I guess it is a decision at some point, isn't it?
I grew up getting taken around to art galleries a lot by my mum and dad. And my dad taught at Glasgow School of Art.
Oh, really?
In the silversmithing and jewellery department. So
wow.
In the design school, as it was called. But anyway, he's an artist. I mean, he works in the field of metalwork and silversmithing and blacksmithing.
Cool.
But so I got brought up getting taken around to a lot of museums and stuff because it was thought to be good for you.
Yeah, well, it's worked. It is good for you.
And my mum's German, and so I also grew up going to Germany a lot, and that's where we went to a lot of... weird Kunsthalle type, you know, because at that time you couldn't see stuff like that in Britain, really.
No, I'm sure,
there was no, but in Germany you could, and you know, things like my grandmother lived in Hanover, which is where the Kurt Schwitter's room is in the Springel Museum, and so anyway, but when I was a teenager, I couldn't decide between art, trying to study art, music, psychology, architecture, and English literature.
And you've combined them all.
That's kind of what your work is.
But and music as well, actually. Did I say that? But I thought that if you did fine art, you could do all of them.
Got it.
Yeah, which you've gone on to do.
And,
yeah.
And it's true as well that I knew people, because I went to UCL. I went to the Slade, which is part of UCL, the university.
Yeah.
So I'd go to the union and meet, you know, people studying English or geography or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I did always think about these other subjects, that the way they were studied seemed awfully, you know, kind of narrow. And, you know, like, why couldn't they be more like art schools where people could kind of work on their own ideas? You know, a lot of it seemed to do with learning stuff, and it was a bit boring.
Yes. Well, you're looking for the light stuff and everything as well, it seems. But I have a question for you then. That comedy-wise, what's your kind of go-to comedy, comedian or show?
Oh, well, I grew up with Billy Connolly.
Okay, cool.
And I love him.
Yes.
And but there's a guy called nowadays who I think, in a way, comes very much from Billy Connolly, called Phil Kaye. He's got, not to be confused with... There's another comedian called Kaye.
Yeah, thingy, Peter Kaye.
Aye.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about Phil Kaye,
who's
Scottish.
Yeah.
He's a Scottish. Because, Kaye that you're talking about, he isn't Scottish.
No, he isn't.
He's from that place. I don't know.
Yes.
Anyway, the north
somewhere
of England.
Not Scotland.
And what is it about his
Phil Kaye has just got a brilliant improvisational style, and he's one of my favorites. Him and Billy Connolly are probably my favorites.
Have you met Billy Connolly?
I have.
Like looking in the mirror, right?
I met him a couple of times, and he is brilliant. And he's exactly the same as well when you meet him. That's the kind of thing everyone says about that, everything.
Yeah.
But he just starts telling a story. And
That is him, isn't it?
He's not different than he is on stage.
Yeah.
Talking about being different from how you are,
right.
Like, I often think about your work, the persona of you. And then this kind of like recently your show at Howser & Worth in London, which is on now. You at the opening, you had it's actually, I think, originally from your music video for Understanding the Song, where you put on glasses and hats. But also in Understanding the Music video, which is also, I think, 2016, it's on YouTube or Martin's website. But there's lots of different yous in that video, which I really wanted to ask you about, because were they all constructed selves? Because in a way, it's almost like you're creating many different people, or are they all you?
It's not very, like a lot of things, I suppose, it's not very thought through.
Okay.
You know, but I've been buying clothes on eBay. Well, before eBay as well, but especially on eBay, that's when it really escalated.
Wow.
The buying vintage clothes, and I don't, you know, men and women's clothes, just things that I like. And actually, I like a lot of women's jackets and things I like, but a lot of men's clothes I find really very boxy.
Yep.
Yeah.
And not
well, the vintage
stuff,
especially, because that was before before David Beckham. So everything we had was just a box cut shirt, wasn't it?
So and buying different things and trying them out, and then that and so, but I don't. But you know, buying things like that, you know, you don't often might not.
But they for you to wear or to use?
Aye, to wear.
Oh right.
But
is this the women's coat you've got on today? Or
it is.
It's lovely.
And actually the shorts, because you can tell partly by the shorter arms.
Oh, yeah.
But I like that, because I hate having things with really long arms where they start, like, if you're I wash my hands a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. So if they start, like, hanging over the edge of the, you know, like, sleeves, dragging onto
horrible.
Things and that.
Yeah. I've got quite long arms, so I try to keep them covered so they don't look... Because I think if you have this flesh showing, they end up looking longer than they should be.
Right.
And you've got perfectly sized arms.
And today you're actually wearing a... Like a, I don't know what you call that, like a
turtleneck, a rainbow turtleneck,
a
Rob.
Collar. That's not, I think it's a collar.
No, that's
a collar.
That's a work.
You know, it is a work. I was going to say.
What?
Because recently, I'd say in the last few years, you started making
these
works, which are my favourite works. And there's one in the show in London right now. And they're natural dyes, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're like scales.
Yeah, these
colour.
Are all natural dyes. So they're not artificial, these colours. They're made from plants and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, well, that's the colours you use are always natural, aren't they? They're not.
Yeah,
like,
they are. Yes. In those tapestries, they are. Yeah.
So a lot of paintings you've made, also the colours are natural, natural dyes.
And no, only in the tapestries is it really natural dyes. In most of the paintings, but the but it depends, because some of them are usually trying to use all the colours equally. That's usually or often one of the big things is to not choose, you know.
And you don't necessarily mix up the paints either, do you?
And it's the same with the clothes, isn't it? Not choosing. Yeah, often not mixing, yeah.
Yeah. So just in a way, it's like the pure colour, like the colour that's come out of the tube will be the colour that you use.
Aye.
Yeah.
Because I don't know which colours are the best ones, you know. I mean, they're all beautiful. So then it's a matter of trying to use them equally. And that's why a lot of the things end up striped. Because if you're trying to...
There's
an equal amount of each colour, then you might end up with stripes.
Yeah. So what's this collar? Yeah. This clicks around your neck, does it?
It just clicks. There's two poppers at the back. And so it's a mini version of the... But I like wearing polo necks and having my neck covered.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how come I ended up making this collar thing.
Yeah, I've got one on today, so I understand.
And in that video, understanding, the other thing I love is your hair. Because there's so many different hairstyles. Yeah. And I know that you've actually included your hair in your exhibitions.
Yeah.
Like you've like cut your hair because apparently when you were growing up, you had a complex relationship with your own hair. Being curly and
what have you. I grew up being very afraid of hair. But I think I've inherited that from my family as well. Because I recently I noticed that they were all talking about hair.
Oh, really?
In a slightly disparaging way, you know.
Body hair.
But hairy people, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who have, you know, well, people go both ways with hair, but there's a lot of people think it should be cut off.
That's a modern thing though, isn't it? That's like,
maybe it
save
is
everything
more
off.
Modern. Yeah.
And how did you decide to start using your hair in your work?
Well, I think that is to do with very much... I think that started with something maybe like the running. I did this piece with people running through a gallery.
Yeah.
And I did, and that, the train of thought that led to that was that, was the idea that everything is a live experience, like I was talking about earlier, you know, that looking at a painting is just as much a live experience as, say, someone singing a song or something like that.
Yes.
And then thinking, okay, why don't I try and make work that really is, that is really obviously happening live, you know? And I thought, well, why don't I have people running, you know, through the gallery? Because if the work's going to be moving kinetically, why not have it as moving as fast as possible? So have people running as fast as they can, you know? And that's how that came about, you know, and also because thinking as well about the fact that, you know, within the idea that work is always live and kinetic, because you're always moving, you're looking at it and you're moving and your heart's beating and you're moving around, so it's always a kinetic experience. But usually the work is moving, is fixed on the wall and you're moving around, and so the running piece came from the idea of trying to just reverse that. And have the work moving faster than the people.
Yeah.
You know.
I remember it in Tate, and when you were just in the Devine galleries or whatever, and people would run by you and it was such a shock.
It's startling.
Yeah, right. And it kind of freaked me out. And I'd be like, what the hell's going on? And I didn't even realise it was work at first, you know. And it's like, it did have that effect, yeah. Which is such a...
Well, I think the current climate as well with, you know, terrorism and stuff, and you're in a...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true,
if you have
actually.
People running past you quickly, your automatic thing is someone's...
I know,
and
in the 80s when I was a kid and you saw people running, you'd think someone was, like, robbing the bank. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, it's sort of built within our...
Yeah.
Within our, within our bodies.
And we're probably told and taught in a public institution, you don't run. That's
yeah,
just
exactly.
a given.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
You're breaking all of those rules with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's actually very funny as well.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, totally.
But also part of that whole thing was I was working with dancers at the time as well, I bet, and doing this stuff on stage with dancers. But I was basically thinking, I'm sitting around here having, thinking about these different ideas and stuff. But what I, before you, in order to be able to do anything, you have to move your body, So to make all of these works and things I was working on, the baseline thing I had to be able to do is move. And that's what, if you're alive, you're moving. If you're not, if you're not moving, you're dead,
yeah.
basically. And yeah. so if you're alive, you're moving. And so living is a matter of moving. And so, I thought, well, work, if I'm going to work on my life, I need to work on my movements. And that's one of the other ideas that led to doing like sort of a thing with runners or dancers.
Yeah.
And but thinking and thinking and then I just started thinking about all works like paint, like so I start thinking about a painting is basically that's a recording of the movements I've made. In fact, all work is basically the ramifications or results of the movements that you make, whether yes. it's talking on the phone or moving your arms around in midair, which is what
oh, I see.
You do if
cutting
you do a
your
painting.
Hair.
And well, and so, but it was, and the other thing is that about it all is that I feel like that it's so starting with your own movements and starting with yourself. And obviously, if you start with yourself, then you're there, with your hair that grows, it grows all the time. You have to deal with that.
Mm.
And then, I started thinking about hair a lot because that's the trouble with hair, this stuff that is always growing, coming out of you. I started equating hair with feelings that, hair is very much like feelings that it's always comes out of you, but you don't really have control over it. You don't choose what your hair, you deal with it as it comes out.
Exactly.
But you don't get to choose whether you've got curly hair or straight hair or whatever. And I think it's noticeable that a lot of people seem to not wish they had hair that was different.
Yes.
Right.
And I feel like it's quite like that with feelings. Often the feelings come up, you're very much at the mercy of them. You don't control, they come up and then you have to
deal with them in the moment. Yeah.
Aye, and then... maybe you try and shape them a bit or whatever. And,
yes.
But so I start thinking that hair and feelings were very, very much the same. But it was more like trying to get work closer to home, really.
Mm.
Thinking, I'm making these movements. Maybe I need to work on this stuff instead of these big ideas over there with some big...
I've always been really interested in hair in art because, the idea that it stores information as well.
Oh,
because
right,
it's like DNA or whatever. And I remember Michael Fullerton, the Scottish painter and conceptual artist, he has used hair a lot in his work. And I really like that. Yeah, and his is all about information and, methods of storing information on all kinds of levels throughout his work. But I was wondering whether that had any interest to you as well, but maybe not. Maybe it's more just about feeling.
I think the thing with hair is that, I definitely grew up with that. There's the idea that, that kind of hairy people were kind of like a bit dangerous. And
really?
I thought
the opposite. I was always like, I loved hair.
Oh, right, But the thing is, like Billy Connolly's really hairy and obviously that's something very in his favour.
To look
favor.
Up to, yes. to aspire to.
I remember that work by a performance artist where she dragged her hair on the floor.
Oh yeah,
cleaning. Is it Duffy's gallery when I was at
when you
art
were studying?
School?
Yeah. I think her name was Janine Antony.
Yeah,
her name.
Aye, that is. Yeah. I think that's right. Aye.
And what was the other work she made? Didn't she?
It was with a it was something with a massive block of chocolate.
That's right. This is what Carl told me about.
And which maybe she'd like gnawed into over period of time. But anyway, I like chocolate.
I like chocolate.
And I like hair.
I love chocolate.
I don't...
Well,
I
know she's your favourite.
Like, combination.
I keep them separate, though.
Yeah, I would. It's like I wouldn't like a bit of hairy
chocolate.
Yeah,
hairy chocolate.
She put them together. And those are the... Yeah, and she... So this one with her hair, she swept the... I believe that she used her hair like a mop and... She swept the floor or mopped the floor. It was in a window, in this kind of shop window. And
where did she eat the chocolate?
Well, I don't
know. It's in the gallery.
I don't know where she ate the chocolate.
Well, I always remember someone, I can't remember who it was, but there was someone that said that when you went into the show, the smell of the chocolate was so intense.
Oh, right.
So it was a really sensory exhibition because it was on so many levels, it worked on different levels. But I love that idea of going into a gallery and smelling chocolate.
I guess, and not being able to eat it.
Maybe that's
someone,
a future work
someone else
you.
Eating it.
Yeah.
You could like pump in chocolate.
I'd like
smells.
To make work with chocolate because. But
have you done a sensory smell? Has any of your work contained smell?
No.
Oh.
Actually, no. No. Mm. I've thought about that. I've often thought about that, but then, you know, and then I didn't. You know, like, but I never...
explored it yet.
I suppose that people, the balloon works...
Yes, the latex
can
smell.
...can be very smelly in terms of the latex.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
But the hair and the clothes... So, you know, working... And that's what I've started... you know, trying to work on just, I suppose, like I say, closer to home. Like, you know, instead of like working on that thing over there, why not work on your, you know, hairstyle? Or
Well, you explore certain themes over and over and over and over again. Like going through this book, the protrusion.
Right.
Appears again and again and again.
It's like
you're trying to exhaust something, but you haven't quite distilled it perfectly just
right.
It was like you're constantly trying to find that next. Do you find that?
Well, that seems like a nice way of putting it because I feel like it's more like, it's like, oh God,
obsession.
I can't help myself. I'm just always, and sometimes when I use notebooks that I carry around.
Because you're recording this today.
I am recording this, but, you know, often it wouldn't get listened to, but I record a lot of things in case some ideas come up or whatever.
Got it. Yes, good.
You know, and I use voice notes as well to make notes, but I also use notebooks to make notes, and I sometimes, you know, if I've got a thing coming up, then I'll take a morning and go through the notebook to see what I was see what ideas I wrote down. But I often notice when I go through my notebooks that, you know, the same thing will be written down, like,
really,
again and again and again. Like, I mean, like, I just like a. And every time I wrote it, I thought I was, you know,
it was fresh.
Like, fuck, I better write this down.
There again, wow.
It's like the same thing, like 20 times, like, and it's like, God.
But what are those things? The protrusion, intrusion, and...
Often, well, it'd just be ideas. Well. So the protrusion thing, that comes to mind in you saying that there's a lot of these in and out things, you know.
Yeah,
but I feel, I don't know if, you know, I often think I'm like a goldfish. You know, they say that a goldfish doesn't
have 2 second memory. That's a good idea. 2 seconds later, that's a good idea. Yeah,
that kind of links to a question I wanted to ask you, actually, just tying everything up. But what do you attribute your longevity to? Like the fact that you've had such a long career and you've also been kind of successful continuously, which I know isn't totally in your control in a way, because I guess, like, I've heard you say as well before that art isn't something that artists actually necessarily make, it's something that gets created by the people looking at it or exhibiting it or saying that it's art, almost that you make things. Or
well, we were talking about this last night, more than any other people, I feel like you're an artist that people project onto and you facilitate that. You want people to project onto you who you are and what the art is,
and somehow their experience becomes part of
their experience what you want. It's so interactive.
I think that because people, everyone, you know, lives in their own world, and so anything else that they might be looking at or listening to or whatever, you know, they are, you know, effectively using that within their own, when we're all in our different worlds that are all in, you know, that are obviously overlapped a lot, but there's no way, like, I feel like I've got no, there's no way I would know how to, you know, communicate with someone else. I think it's I don't know how communication takes place, you know.
You mean only, in art, with through art,
in any way at all? I think that everyone's in their own world, you know, that and mm-hmm. But the only way that I feel able to really think about it is that I'm an example of a person, you know, and therefore, if I try to, you know, live as best I can,
yeah,
and in the world, that then hopefully that might and the things I do might rhyme with someone else, you know, who's in their world.
Got it.
But I feel like it's often a mistake to think that you can communicate, to think that you can, you know, let's say make someone else feel something or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's really, I feel like that's a dangerous path.
Do you think that's quite an arrogant thing to think, I'm going to create something that's going to affect loads of people?
Aye, and that's the kind of route towards trying to be, you know, sort of manipulative or whatever. You know, because people, you know, bring what they bring to things, and, you know, what they find in them. And, you know, I can't control that. So I may as well forget. Yeah. About trying to do that, even though I might I wish I could, part of me wishes I could, but...
So your work is like a good deed. You're paying it forward. Basically, is what it seems.
But also, I guess you just have to keep living your life, and through living your life and you communicating through your work is somehow it's just going to continue, because that is, so that in a way is the secret to your longevity, is just being alive on some level.
Yeah, so keep living.
I guess. Keep living.
Well, I got to say, you are a lovely man. Right. So whatever energy.
Honestly, I could talk
there,
to you for hours. Every time I've spent time with you, I leave feeling really
energized,
exhilarated, and interested in kind of thinking about things, and I don't know, I love being around you. And I'm really, I said to Russell last night, I'm just so happy, it sounds really a bit silly actually, but so happy that your work exists. because I actually think it improves people's lives in a way. And I'm sure it's improved your life, because it's helped you.
Well, I think it's helped me.
Yeah, totally. And I heard in one of your interviews where you were talking about how sometimes you make things because you might not be feeling that great or something, not necessarily depressed, but just like you're just trying to struggle with existing somehow, and therefore you create, which I really relate to. But I also think by that act of creating and the things you create, your work is a really positive, hopeful, thought-provoking kind of universe.
That was what you were saying. Most people make art when they are sad or out of a need of trying to get something out, to exercise something, whereas you were saying that you want to make the work when you're feeling good.
I think both or all of the whatever we, but I do think that feeling bad is one of the most common, you know, inspirations for work, because I feel like when you're feeling very good, then you might tend to try not to change anything.
Got it.
Let's just stay here if we're feeling good. Yeah.
But the kind of thing that'll make you get up and, you know, go out or phone someone up or start a whole ball rolling, that might lead to, that would maybe tend to be, you know, you might be frustrated or something like that.
Yeah. So do you catch yourself emotionally and go, okay, this is where you're at now, let's try and make work in this?
I do. Yeah. But I also I find it, you know, motivated, very difficult often to get motivated, you know, if I'm at home in my little kingdom, you know, with my cups of tea and, and I'm so I really fear that kind of, like, you know, just end up sitting around on the sofa the whole time, kind of, because I get bored then, dude. I don't like that. So I try to, I often think that trying to work is often like, you know, it's like basically you have to find a cliff, you know, and jump off it, you know, and then, because
metaphorically,
then,
obviously.
And then you're in the, and then you're in the water, and you just have to swim for your life, you know. But often working is a matter of finding some kind of cliff like that.
Got it.
That you know, perhaps safer than just an actual cliff.
Got it. And do you have to find a different cliff each time? Once you, once
aye.
You, You have to push yourself out.
Aye, because you learn about the currents and you start like getting
there's not
clever
that bit,
and working out how you can just lie on a lilo.
Yeah.
I think that is, you're finding a new, that is, I think that jumping into areas where you don't know what you're doing.
Mm.
I think that's the scariest thing, I feel like, is if you think you know what you're doing in a situation.
If you've mastered something.
Aye.
Yeah.
That's when you're
going to
just flip into.
But you like
wank.
To set you set yourself up to fail, and you never seem to.
Well, but I think
that's
I
the
do.
Way. That seems to be you. Like you set yourself up to expose yourself completely and put yourself out there and go like, "Here I am, come on
in."
And that's the kind of default position where you throw yourself out into the world.
Aye, I think, well, it feels like that sometimes. I mean, it's a bit, I mean, maybe it's a bit of a death wish type thing.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's a form, it's like a, I mean, I've never been bungee jumping and I wouldn't want to.
No, I don't either.
But, I don't want to either.
But I feel like it's something, it is like that.
Yes.
You know, it's some kind of like, and it's, you know, the rush comes when you're near to.
I chatted to a friend of ours the other day about skydiving, and she was saying that the moment you jump out of the plane, you feel the kind of, because you're doing it. But the minute you're in the air, you don't feel anything because it's really boring, apparently.
Right, really?
Apparently, it's very calm because you're just, the air is obviously hitting your body or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's quite slow, kind of calm thing. And the only nerve-wracking bit is, will your parachute go up?
Yeah.
All right.
But even at that point, she said that it's so calm that it wasn't at all what she expected. Whereas I think bungee jumping is probably a bit more intense and crazy. I couldn't deal with that. Right. But I quite liked the idea of skydiving now, weirdly. I don't think I'm going to necessarily...
Skydive.
Oh, did
really?
You?
Yeah, yeah. I did over the Blue Mountains in Sydney.
While
I was doing the History Boys on tour, and me and Jamie Parker had to sneak off and do it. Because if they found out we'd done a skydive, I think we'd have been like...
Because
we'd have been like, what? We did it. Yeah, it was that experience. You when you get jumping out of the plane with like this man on your back, you're like, this is... bonkers, and then when you're in the air it's exhilarating, but you're like, okay, this isn't what I thought it would feel like. And then when they pull the parachute and then you're spinning down, it's kind of it's terrifying.
Well, on this topic, I think that's a great way to close this interview.
Oh, yes.
is that we should all try something new.
Yes.
And don't settle for like where you're at. Try and learn something new. Jump out of a plane. And everybody should buy Martin's book, Martin Creed Works, and also his albums of music, and see all his shows. You've got loads of things coming up. I know you've got the live performance at the Barbican.
Oh, that's right.
As well.
Oh, yeah.
You've got lots of things coming up.
That's
We will add all the images we've been talking about of Martin's work onto our Instagram at Talk Art.
Yep.
Please leave reviews and let us know what you think. And
what a total pleasure to have you here today.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Wonderful man. Thank you very much.
A good one.
Cheers, Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.